hope that the time may pass pleasantly and profitably for you this afternoon. And I sincerely appreciate your presence and your coming to think with us for a little while about what is happening to our families. I think that most of us understand that the home or the family is humanity's oldest social institution. And the truth is that it is the ultimate foundation of orderly society, and it is designed to promote the happiness of mankind. If one were to try to visualize the family's functions, I think we could properly say that there are some three distinctive functions of the family. And one of these might be a double hitter, so to speak. One of these functions of the family is that of the honorable procreation of the human species. And when I say honorable, I'm talking about that which God would approve. I think all of us understand that illegitimacy somewhere involves sin. And it is shameful. And the truth is that it brings only sorrow to the parents and to the offspring. A second function of the family is the gradual introduction of the child to general society. This usually involves some 18 to 20 years from the time of birth till the child is pretty well on his own. And then a third function of the family, if I understand correctly, would be the education of the child. And this might be done by the state, or shall I say through state agencies, or through some private media. And we're thinking here basically about schooling, of course. Now this training necessarily involves various aspects of the child's development. There's the development of his mind and the development of his physical body and what we would call his social development or his relationship to his fellow beings. And then, of course, his moral and or his religious development. And tied into this, obviously, particularly this latter part, from a biblical viewpoint, both the husband and the wife and the parent-child relationships are to be implemented with wisdom. And since the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, the basic question for every member of the family is, what does the Lord require? What does the Lord require of me as a husband? What does he require of my spouse as a wife? What does he require of me as a parent toward my child? And what does he require of me as a child toward my parent, if that parent or those parents still live? Somebody has said that as goes the home, so goes the nation. This is a rather old adage, I think, but it's one that has a lot of truth in it. And this doesn't refer necessarily to the mental and the economic and the social and the physical aspects of family life. But I think that this idea of the way the family goes, so goes the nation, basically involves the thought of morality. And of course, this is really the primary point of our immediate thinking together this afternoon. What is happening to our families? Different people, of course, would have different views of this, but I'm thinking about it primarily from the viewpoint of the way a Christian would, or as I think at least should, view this whole scope of the physical relationships and the moral and the spiritual implications that are involved in the families as we come to know them, or as to the family as an institution. I would like to sort of get underway this afternoon basically by suggesting to you some what I would call modern challenges to modern family life. And one of those challenges comes in the realm of technological advances that have been made in the last half century, and many of them in the last 25 or 30 years. I'd like to suggest to you, first of all, that there is more information available about more things at the present time than any other time in the history of the world, and that would be an obvious observation by any of us. But the thing that impresses me as I talk with some of the people that gather statistics, and particularly the computer people, is to how rapidly it is changing insofar as the information we get. Now, if I could have a bucket, for example, and I held that bucket in this hand, and I had another bucket, and I held that bucket in this hand, and I could get all of the information that has been a matter of record for men to study some way, somehow, from the beginning of recorded history to the year 1975. And if I could get all that in one bucket, and then I could get together all of the information that mankind has obtained and has been made a matter of record from 1975 to the year 1984, just 2 years ago, I would have as much information in bucket number two as I would have in information in bucket number one. And I've got a suspicion that if we could know the truth, and I haven't made a check on this just recently, but I've got a suspicion that we might change that figure from 1975 up to about 1980 and say that we have as much information now obtained in the last 4 or 5 years as has ever been obtained and recorded in the history of the human family from the beginning of recorded history to 1980. We're living in unbelievable times insofar as things that are available to the human mind for mankind to study. And there's something else that is interesting about this technological advance or advancement, and that is that there are more and better media for obtaining this information than at any other time in the history of the world. There was a time that I used to hear say if you wanted to learn anything real fast, you could get some things on the telephone, you could get some things on the teletype, but you could get it a lot faster if you just tell a woman. Now, I never have necessarily bought that, but when you stop to think about the technological advances again, you think about the newspaper and the teletype and the radio and the television. And our ancestors would never have dreamed of would never have dreamed of such means of obtaining information. And not only is this true, but when you stop to think about it, ours is the only generation in the history of the human family that a person can sit in his own living room and see not a reproduction, but at the very moment it's taking place, a real blood and gut killing war on the other side of the earth. You ever thought about that? That's something that has evolved over a period of years, and television has brought that to us. Seeing wars literally fought, people die on the other side of the earth at the very instant it's taking place. And then in addition to this, there are more and better transportation facilities that mankind has ever known before, and all of these transportation facilities have tended to amalgamate, fuse together, bring together, mix up, and make one the human family generally. You see, our ancestors knew a means of transportation that we think of as the ox cart, as the covered wagon days in the settlement of this country. And now there are certain type planes that allowing for the time changes, the time belts or zones. A fella can leave the East Coast, he could leave New York City and get to Los Angeles before he left. I heard about the fella that was over in Atlanta, and he was looking through the airport fence. One of his neighbors just happened to pass by and see him. He just stopped and asked this fella. He said, "What are you doing here?" Well, he said, "I heard about this airplane that's going to leave Atlanta at 8 o'clock, and it is going to get to Birmingham before it left." And he said, "You know what I'm here for? I just want to see that thing take off." And we're almost living in those times, aren't we? You just think about getting in on an airplane, which I did last Monday in Tampa, Florida, and 2 hours later met the brethren up here at Pittsburgh that came after me to bring me down here to preach these long sermons all week. In the morning they'll take me back. I'll mount the airplane it'll take off if it's on schedule about 9:55, I believe they say, in the morning, call that 10 o'clock, and I'll be in Tampa 2 hours later. Same speed going back, speed coming up. Transportation, the world itself, 25,000 miles or thereabout or around the earth, and yet it's just a matter of a few hours. I've forgotten how long it was that Columbus was on the ocean finding the new world, and yet there are some of us in this audience today that have crossed the Atlantic in just a few hours. I used to hear some of the old timers that had made trips to the Bible lands and visited the Near East and gone over Egypt and Palestine and Greece, parts of Asia Minor, and I'd hear them lecture about what they had seen. And you know, I remember hearing Brother N.B. Hardiman one time talk about that, and whatever the auditorium was, and it was a whopper. People just came from all over the Upper Cumberland area, which is a part, of course, of the Appalachian chain, over at Cookeville, Tennessee, and they couldn't even see the people that came to hear him. He'd made a trip to Bible lands, he and Brother Ira Douthat. And people were interested in that thing. Well, now it's a very common occurrence for just almost anybody to get up a load, as the saying goes, and and travel to Bible lands and travel around the world, China, Japan, Egypt, wherever they want to go, South Africa, and be gone, visit a couple of weeks if you want to stay, or maybe 3 weeks and come back. And that just becomes a sort of a vacation anymore. And the things that some of us used to sit just spellbound listening to these fellows talk. Well, they talk, they walk where the prophets walked. They walk where Moses walked. They walk where Jesus and the apostles walked. Well, that seemed like a million years ago and thousands upon thousands of miles away. And the miles were there, all right, but the ages and the time are not anymore. All of which says what? That we're living in times and under circumstances and conditions in this world as a people. And we're rearing our families, raising our children in climate and in conditions and under circumstances that our ancestors of just a generation or two ago could not even imagine if they were told that such would become a reality. If I had said to my father, who died in 1962, if I had said to him, or 19 and, I beg your pardon, it's 19, 50. If I'd have said to my father when I was a boy, Dad, I'm going to live to see men walk on the moon, he'd say, boy, what's wrong with your education? Has somebody been feeding you a bunch of stuff? It's just not so. And if he'd have said to me, boy, you live to see people walk on the moon, I'd thought my daddy lost his mind. And yet most of us have seen men walk on the moon. I've spent all this time talking to you about some of these things to suggest to you that though none of them have moral implications per se, your family and my family and its stability, the stability of our family members, may be affected and will be affected by all of these things that we're now beginning to take for granted. The sad part about some of this that we're thinking about with reference to the family is that morality standards have become and are increasingly so a focal point of these technological changes. And this is best seen, of course, I suppose, in terms of our modern communication media, radio and television and the printing press, instantaneously bringing the rest of the world into every modern home. And the automobile and the airplane shorten both time and distance between every family domicile and the rest of humanity scattered over the earth. And thus, there is exposed every modern family to every facet of life throughout our own country and to the lifestyle of much, if not most, of the rest of the world. And yet you and I, if we have children, are going to have to raise them in this kind of an environment. Are you prepared to do it? Have these things that I've been talking about had a big impact already on the lifestyle of your own family? And have these things had any kind of an effect at all upon your children? The truth is that the morality of the family members has become the target of the communications media. And especially, I think, has that been true of television and to a great degree the yellow magazine medium. Sickening indeed is the emphasis which glorifies divorce and fornication and drinking and homosexuality and prostitution and profanity and vulgarity and drugs. And if you've got a name for it, anything else that appeals to the fleshly appetite of man. This immoral garbage that we have reference to here is dumped inside the living room of the average American in the very innermost part of the domicile in which we live, by television and by radio and by the printing press. And guess who pays for the delivery of all that stuff? You and I, basically, as parents, pay for it. We're the ones that are paying for the bills. When we buy the advertised products, radio and television couldn't stay on there if they didn't have it commercially unless the government paid for it. Present time, and so that means that in our own country, Mr. and Mrs. America is paying or are paying for the bills that are involving the moral standards of American life and probably the conduct of our own children. And the saddest part of all in connection with this is that many professed Christians have it so. We have it so. We pay our part in the bill. And there's some of us that had a lot rather stay and watch Dallas or whatever some of the others might be named, and I don't even know them. Just full of filth and adultery, fornication, drinking, carousing. We'd much rather watch that and fill our minds with it and allow our children to absorb it than we had to sit in the church house for an hour. Right? That's not even debatable, is it? That's the situation. Well, what are some of the contributions that parents are making toward these conditions that I have mentioned? One of the contributions that families making or parents are making to this is their absenteeism from their own children. And this absenteeism in too many instances is not only constant, but it is repetitive. Interests outside the immediate family circle often become so enthralling that front-line duties toward their own children distract parents from a once-upon-a-time closeness so direly needed by children as well as by parents as the parents are growing older and as the children are maturing. We live in an age when we're really making, many of us are, our children orphans while we live in the same house, but not necessarily at the same time. This is an age of airplane travel and rapid automobile transit. And daddy goes across the country to some kind of a meeting of his particular branch or subdivision of a national company, and mama goes with him, and the boys and girls are left to eat out of tin cans and the baked goods that are had from the supermarket. And if this was just a one-time deal once in a while, it might not be so bad, but when you find it so frequently, it becomes a canker within itself. Country club life, business circuitry of conventions and banqueting where one or both mates are so frequently, and as I say, often regularly, away from their children and from each other. At a paid point in life when the one thing the children are needing more than anything else in the world is the stability of at least one parent, if not two parents all the time, as sort of corner posts in their family and in their development. And this kind of a situation, what I'm trying to say to you is, creates insecurity, and it creates instability. It increases loneliness, and it creates a fear among children themselves, who dearly need security and who need stability and who need companionship of parents. And along with all this, which assurance is only that which really parents can give. This is not an imagined situation. I didn't just make that up. But where you sit today, those of you who are here, who've thought enough about what I might say, and some of you younger parents, particularly I'm interested in, when you stop to analyze it, you know that's true. You know that's true. I'm really not saying anything that you're not that's not happening, and you might not have thought about it that way, but when I call it to your attention, you say, yeah, that's happening all around me. I'm going to try to stay with my kids as much as I can. I'm going to try to see what goes on in our house. While Dad's away on a trip, I'm at least not going to take off and be gone a week or 10 days, and then another week or 10 days, another month later do it, and then just 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 times during the year, I'm going to turn my kids over to just nobody. Just let them come and go. I doubt that there are many of you in this building that are doing that, but I want to tell you, there are a lot of people that are, and there are a lot of people that profess to be Christians that are doing it. And then we wonder, what in the world has happened to society? What's happening to our country? Why is it so many people are interested in taking drugs? Why is it there's such a breakdown in immorality and such a great increase in pregnancy out of wedlock, and 13 and 14 and 15 year old girls having babies and now having abortions by the carload. And not only that, but with the approval of parents in many instances who just don't want to feed another face, and who really are not ashamed of the things that are happening and just don't care much. And when I say much, not enough to do anything about it in their own families. That's what's happening to our families. It is one of the things. And I'm saying to you that absenteeism from the family is a major cancer in the modern American home. You remember the hippies? Everybody felt like that a hippie smelled bad, and a lot of them did. Hippieism was the thing of the day about 20, 25 years ago. Everybody's concerned about hippieism. And it was about that time that I made a trip out to California to hold two or three meetings, and I was in the San Francisco area. And you remember one of the great hippie centers of the world was Pipe Ashbury. You remember that settlement? Well, I visited Hyatt Ashbury at the very peak of its, just as starry-eyed as she was, and she's just as pregnant as she can be. And I look out across an expanse there, I suppose, of 15 to 20 acres. And there are literally hundreds of them just in that one given area. And they don't anymore know what's going on in the world of reality than the man in the moon, if there was a man in the moon that had stayed there. And you know something else I learned about that? That there are a lot of those little 13 and 14 and 15 and 16 year old youngsters, both girls and boys, that their own daddies and mothers were sending them a check every month of the world, and some of them twice or three times a month, to support them in that kind of a lifestyle. And now you see these boys and girls, these little youngsters running around just barely out of diapers, and they're the daddies and the mothers of the ones that their age now. That's something I witnessed with my own eyes. I'm not guessing about that. I know it's so. And there were settlements and colonies of that kind scattered all over this country. And not only over this country, but in other parts of the world, particularly in Great Britain and some of the Western European countries, where theoretically Christianity had had some effect in earlier years. And this is the generation. Don't forget that. This is the generation, theoretically, that's now mature out of the fathers and the mothers of the young teenagers and some of the later teenagers at the present time. And these are the ones that are having their say in politics and in this and that and the other. Yes, I think we ought to do a whole lot of singing, God Bless America. But if I understand when we're talking about God blessing Mary, that means that's talking about blessing folks. And God's not going to shower His blessings indeterminately and forevermore on that kind of a state of morality in this country. Rome governed the world, but Rome fell. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. And I want to tell you something else. You can just enlarge that man to men, or mankind, whatsoever mankind soweth. Whatever this world sows, it's going to reap one of these days. And this nation, just as certain as some of the other already demoralized and depleted nations, is going through the ringer. We can't thumb our noses at God and disregard God without reaping the consequences of rebellion and disregard for moral and spiritual principles. That's one of the things that's happening to our nation, but primarily because it is happening in the homes. It's happening in the families. And that is, and mothers are really not doing anything about it much. Now there are some parents who are a little concerned about what's happening, and they feel bad about neglecting their children like they do. And so they make some kind of an attempt to atone for the lack of personal time and care with and of their children. And so they provide autos for them. They provide travel for them. They buy expensive clothing for them. They give them rather liberal allowances, and somehow we feel that that's going to take care of the moral depression that we find ourselves in. That's like the fellow that comes and sits in on the church house front seat and eats the Lord's Supper every Sunday and lives like the devil the other 6 days of the week. And we think we're not going to, that a church is not going to pay the price for that kind of immorality of the God, at the judgment of our God. If it isn't, it's going to pay the price, and our nation is. Our nation is. And where does it begin? It begins at the hearthrug. That's the sad part about it. Just that's where it actually could be resolved if there were enough family units that were willing to work on the program. But I'm talking to you about some things that are happening to our families, and nobody apparently is doing much about it. And you say, well, now, what is it could happen at my house? Or what is it that is really contributing to this moral decay that we're talking about? I want to give you some of them. Besides just the absenteeism from children, we come along and we try to atone for that by buying them expensive gifts. Just like I said a while ago, sometimes it's an automobile. But when mothers begin to leave their little children in the care of somebody else, I don't believe that there is a woman on earth, if she knows what is involved in motherhood, that can really give to her children, can hire somebody to give to her children what she can give if she's conscientious about what she's going to do with reference to right or wrong and the things that are best for the children. In the last 50 years, beginning with Ruby the Riveter, in World War II, mamas all over this country and the world started working by the masses. Oh, there's always been an isolated case here and there, but started by the masses, mothers. I'm not talking about maidens who held clerk jobs and secretarial jobs and things like that and didn't have family responsibilities. I'm talking about mothers that left their children in the care of somebody else. Literally, they left them by the millions. That is, there were millions of them that left home to go to the marketplace. And when the war is over, they never did go back home. They got a taste of the lifestyle that an extra dollar would bring in terms of material things. And we're paying the price for it today. And instead of that leap to the public marketplace decreasing, it has increased 4 or 5-fold in the last 15 or 20 years. That's what's happening, folks. And I'm not mad at any of my good sisters, and I'm not mad at any of my brothers. But that's what's happening to other people's home, and bless your soul, it can happen to yours. Don't kid yourself. While the cat's away, the mice will play. That's not pleasant to say that. But I believe with all my heart that it's so. And so what does mama do when she leaves to go to the marketplace? Well, she tries to atone for her absence, I say, by bringing them gifts. And she buys expensive gifts, Cadillac gifts, way up yonder in the dollar measure gifts, just real fancy toys and other things. And a little child just soon to have a spool. Or something that moves a little bit is to have something that might cost $50, $75, or $100. And this is what we're doing. We are really paying for our conscience. That's our conscience saying. Well, what happens when Mama goes to the marketplace? Well, first of all, she's got to buy more and better clothing, and she's got to buy transportation, and she's got to pay taxes on the income that she earns, and to a great degree, she's going to neglect the routine household chores that she one time looked after. That's some of the things that are going to have to happen. Everybody knows that. But the sad part of all of it is that she's going to have to spend fewer hours with the very children that didn't ask to be born and that she has been the mother of in bringing them into the world. You ever thought about that? And what we do, to a great extent, insofar as the touch and the constant, timely care of a mother, we make them orphans while sleeping under the same roof. Did you hear what I said? We tend to make our own children orphans while sleeping. I said, I didn't say living, I said sleeping under the same roof. And that brings me to my chart. That's the only chart I've got to use during this whole meeting. I put it up there a while ago. It doesn't tell you much. I hadn't had to put those words out there. You'd been wondering, had the fella lost his mind and started back in first grade arithmetic? But I want you to look at the figures. There are 24 hours in a day. And we're told by some of the expert authorities that we ought to have at least 8 hours sleep a night, and particularly is that true with smaller children. And so if we put our bad children to bed and they get 8 hours of sleep, that would leave 16 hours in the day that we wouldn't have any immediate mental contact with them, would we? It'd be 8 hours gone to bed. Well, everybody nearly has got little children. We've got to make it on 16 hours. But in this particular instance, we're talking about the mama that works away from the children, and she's going to work 8 hours now. That's going to be about it. And so if she works away from home 8 hours a day, that leaves 8 hours that she would have with her children if she was awake and they were awake when we were at home, right? It's not allowed for anything else, but liars may figure, but figures don't lie. So that cuts us down 8 hours. Now, I don't believe I'd call Page City. No reflection on Page City. I like it up here. But I wouldn't call Page City one of the great labor centers of America, would you? And it really doesn't talk thick, you fellas at work. Or you women that work either in these mills around here, in factories and so on, it really doesn't take you long to get from here to there. And to get from there back here. Wherever here and there are. But, you ever been in Los Angeles? You ever been in New York City? You ever tried Cleveland? You ever been in Denver? You ever been in Houston? Chicago? Maybe? Do you know how long it takes a lot of people to get from where they live to work? Earn a living? Mama's going to help out now. And she's going to travel. told to some of the folks that's so supposed to know in these big population centers that the average woman worker does not spends a minimum, I'm talking about the average now, of an hour getting to the place where she begins to earn her dough. Well, it'd be the same distance back home, so it wouldn't get there, wouldn't it? So that means that she would spend 2 hours a day traveling. Well, she just had 8 hours when she started, with left to spend with any time with her kids, and now two of them's gone, and so that leaves her 6 hours with her offspring. If she had that much time. But where is the woman from the time she gets up to she gets off to work that can get it all done in an hour? One old brother said it this way. He said, yeah, it takes her 2 hours to get there and to get back, and it takes another 2 hours for her to get ready to go and to get unready after she gets back. And now, girls, you know that's the truth. I'm married, too. So we've got two now to take away from six. And that leaves, I want all of you to see that my arithmetic's correct. That last big letter I put down there is a four. If this is correct, in the great metropolitan work centers of this world, of this country, 5 days a week, the best you can do to say that you can give yourself unreservedly to your children, if this is your picture, would be 4 hours. Somebody said, yeah, but just think, I got Saturday and Sunday. Yeah, that's right, you have. You got Saturday and Sunday. And you're married? Old John, you know, if he's not awful careful, he's going to get squeezed out in this deal some way. He's going to be just like the toothpaste coming out of a toothpaste tube. He's going to be on the outside. We got to do it all now. John's already working too, you know. He's trying to put bread on the table, but now Mama's gone, and so she's got 4 hours late. And you know as well as I do, girls, that there are enough things that break loose at home in the 5 days that you've gone from home to work that if you worked all the time, you'd have a pretty hard job just keeping them patched up. I can just see women all over this house shaking their heads. Yes, say, dear, you're agreeing with me. I've got a lot of votes here today. And that's so. And so, really what we do is to reason ourselves into thinking that if we'll just do all these things that will bring us more dollars, we can have more and better things for our youngsters than old John or Bill or Sam or Henry can bring home. So we're going to do our part, and we do. And in too many instances, and if it's just one, that's too many. Too many instances, we make orphans of our own children. There are a lot of folks that would scoff me out of the building. I want to tell you something, folks. I've been married nearly 40 years. I didn't marry my wife to make my living. I didn't marry my wife to be anything other than whatever God meant for a woman to be to a man. and to her offspring. I married her to love me. You say that's selfish. That's right. But she needed in return what I could give her. And that's the way it was when God set it all up in Eden a long time ago. And we talked about children before we ever married. She's making more money than I was when we married. And we've had it pretty rough. I've seen the time when we had to skimp just to have food on the table. To feed ourselves and to feed our children. But there's one thing that I've never lacked for. And that's the undivided devotion and love of my wife. And I've had to be away from home a lot to do some of the things I'm doing right here today and this week. And she's been both a father and a mother when I'm away. But I never had the first question to rise in 40 years about whether my children, when they were at home before they married, whether or not she knew where they were and what they were doing, with whom they were, or where they were at night, or where she was at night. And for all practical purposes, insofar as the security of mind was concerned and peace of heart, I could say in all good conscience, I could feel just as safe about their moral and spiritual welfare as I could when I was there. I want to tell you something else. That kind of a state of mind and contentment of heart is not for sale. There is not any dollar mark that could be worth the exchange for that. And I have a suspicion that down deep in your heart, Mother, you feel the same way. It takes a heap of living, the poet said, in a house to make it home. And that's right. And it takes a heap of loving, lest the husband roam. And it takes a love for children to cause them to love that same home and that same relationship. I don't want to make my children orphans while they're living. But Mama goes to the workplace and it takes all this time that we're talking about. But she's forced to share her motherhood experiences with another woman or many women, maybe several women if they're put in a daycare. And after a while, Mother begins to develop maybe some conscience problems with reference to her own absenteeism. And the little child cries after her as she leaves home in the morning. And she wants to atone for that some way. And so what does she do? She begins to buy them expensive gifts out of that salary that she's making. And she tries to atone and for her absenteeism, and the little child doesn't care any more about a $100 gift or a $50 gift than it would a 10-cent piece. It doesn't have any economic measuring rods for value. But a mama begins to worry about it, and she puts the conscience salve on by buying things. T-H-I-N-G-S, things. As if that will take the place of motherhood. And as time passes, she begins to develop emotional problems. shall I say, that her maternal love turns to a sort of a pressure situation that exists, and the child begins to develop emotional problems as the mother is not always as thoughtful and as kind as she could be otherwise, and so the child begins to get upset, and what does the mother do with the child? She takes it to the medical doctor, to the child specialist. And the child specialist analyzes the situation, and he knows what the real problem is. You're going to ask me in a minute about how do you know so much about that, preacher? You're not a medical doctor. You're not a pediatrician. You're not a child care specialist. No, but I got some friends that are. I can give you the names and addresses of some of them. If you want to check that out, see whether or not I'll tell you the truth about it. And so mama takes the child to the doctor, and the doctor knows that it's really not a problem that the child can easily resolve, because the problem is the mother. She's the one that has developed the emotional problems, and because she's developed emotional problems, her guilt complex begins to work on her, and she puts the pressure on the child, and it comes out of the child, but the mother's the problem. You know Dr. Jim McCain in Jacksonville, Florida? I think you do. Went to school to me when he was just an 18-year-old boy. One of the most beloved child care doctors in Jacksonville, Florida. I went down the line at the very church where he's an elder in Jacksonville many years ago. This has been, I guess, close to 18 or 20 years ago. They want me to come up there and talk about the family. And that's what we're talking about now, one of them. And I went down this list. 1, 2, 3, 4. This is what happens when mama leaves her children in the care of somebody else. This is the routine of what goes through. And he's sitting in the back of the building. And as soon as the invitation song was over, he was standing at the front of the building, and he said, "I want to shake your hand." He said, "You didn't tell it the way nearly it was." He said, "You described it to a T." He says, "The mother's where the problem is with nearly every emotionally upset child. It's not the child that's really sick, and you get the mother back where the mother ought to be, taking care of the little child, and all the problems will be solved. But she's got this guilt complex you're talking about, and she's trying to dollar herself out of the way of it, and thinks that that's going to take care of her own love and her care of her own child." He said, it's just like dominoes. He said, "You can set up a set of dominoes here, and you've done that before, and you've seen them on television, yeah, and where they run thousands of them, you know, just push down one, it takes them everywhere." He said, "That's exactly the way it is. One situation sets up another situation, and that one creates a third situation, and it's on down the line. And who is it that gets the cahoots? The doctor told me it's the little child." Well, that's just the testimony of one medical doctor that's a Christian. There's some others scattered around over the country, and every time I've found one that professed to be a disciple of the Lord, I've gone to him and asked him the question without even telling him what Dr. McCain told me. And one or two women scattered around over the country that I've run into that are also medical doctors, but even they, and in both instances that I talked to women, as I recall now, they'd already raised their children before they started the medical practice, but they said they had exactly the same experience, and one of them's married to a pediatrician. And he told me the same thing. And so when you start to study the expert advice, I'm not talking off the top of my head. I'm just telling you some facts, what's happening. Now, I realize that a lot of us could say, "Well, I can be the exception to the rule. That's not going to happen at my house." I'm talking about little children that we bring into the world, and then we make orphans of them while they are little and dependent. You know, there's one fellow in all of this kind of things that that never did have a vote. You ever thought about that? Papa votes for it maybe reluctantly. And Mama votes for it that I'm going to do it. But I want to tell you, there's one member of the family that never did get to vote. He wasn't even consulted, or she wasn't consulted. Do you know who that was? That is the little child. If the little child could answer, I'll ask you the question, how would it vote? For its own mother or for a substitute mother? How would you vote? And she said, Brother Cope, I'm going to do something about it. Not sure how I can do it, but I'm going to do something about this. She said, this morning, when I left home to go to my job, my little girl followed me to the front door, and as I went down the steps, she was crying, and she said, Mama, are you going to leave me again today? Doesn't that tell the story? Beloved, what's happening to our families is what's happening to our nation. That's the way it is. That's the way it is. I wish I could say it another way and deliver my conscience, but I can't. I never met Temple Bailey. But I tell you one thing, she left something that I've left all over this country everywhere I've gone. She wrote a little piece called A Parable for Mothers. Some of you read it. And I want to close with it today. Some other things that I'd like to say, but you've already patiently listened for a long time. But I want to read you this. There's not anything on earth. You see, the beautiful part about motherhood is this is what God gave little children. And which God, and the ones that God said about mothers to be keepers at home. Keepers at home. I'm not real certain about what all mothers to keep, but they're to be in the home when they do it. Home's where they keep it. I didn't say that. God did. The God that made a mother. The God that made a husband. The God that had made a father. The God that made marriage. And the God that made little children. That's what he said about it. And I have a suspicion that he knew best. But Temple Bailey said, the young mother set her foot on the path of life. Is the way long, she asked. And her guide said, yes, and the way is hard. And you will be old before you reach the end of it. But the end, get it? But the end will be better than the beginning. But the young mother was happy, and she would not believe that anything could be better than these years. And so she played with her children, and she gathered flowers for them along the way, and she bathed with them in the clear streams, and the sun shone on them along the way, and life was good. And the young mother cried, nothing will ever be lovelier than this. Then night came, and the storm, and the path was dark, and the children shook with fear and cold, and the mother drew them close and covered them with her mantle. And the children said, oh, mother, we're not afraid, for you are near, and no harm can come. And the mother said, of this, is better than the brightness of day. For I have taught my children courage. And the morning came, and there was a hill ahead, and the children climbed, and they grew weary. And the mother was weary, but at all times she said to the children, "A little patience, and we're there." So the children climbed, and when they reached the top, they said, "We could not have done it without you, mother." And the mother, when she lay down that night, looked up at the stars, and she said, "This is a better day than the last. For my children have learned fortitude in the face of hardness. Yesterday I gave them courage. Today I have given them strength." And the next day came strange clouds which darkened the earth. Clouds of war and hate and evil. And the children groped and they stumbled. And the mother said, "Look up, lift your eyes to the light." And the children looked, and they saw above the clouds an everlasting glory. And it guided them and brought them beyond the darkness. And that night, the mother said, "This is the best day of all. For I have shown my children God." And the days went on, and the weeks, and the months, and the years. And the mother grew old, and she was little, and she was bent. But her children were tall, and they were strong, and they walked with courage. And when the way was hard, they helped their mother. And when the way was rough, they lifted her, for she was as light as a feather. And at last they came to a hill, and beyond that hill they could see a shining road and golden gates flung wide. And the mother said, "I have reached the end of my journey. And now I know that the end is better than the beginning. For my children can walk alone. And their children after them." And the children said, "You will always walk with us, Mother, even when you have gone through the gates." And they stood and they watched her as she went on alone. And the gates closed after her. And they said, "We cannot see her. But she is with us still, a mother like ours is more than a memory. She is a living presence." I close by asking one question. How is it at your house? Let's stand up and sing.